Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
If you're a farmer in New York State, join the New York State Grown and Certified program to let people know your food is grown right here. Learn more at certified.ny.gov.
I'm Erin Fairbanks, host of The Farm Report. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Carmen DeVito.
And I'm Alice Marcus Krieg.
And we are the ladies of Groundworks, Inc. We design and build gardens in New York City and the surrounding area, and our show aims to bring some culture to horticulture. It got really cold.
It is freezing, and there are snowflakes.
Yeah, we got some winter in a fierce way.
We didn't get any snow, though.
No, I did feel some hail the other night on the window.
Got a lot of snow, New York, upstate New York.
Yeah, but we got cold rain, and suddenly, like, fall is gone. The beauty, winter's here, at least for the next few days.
Sticks.
And we still have a lot of work to do. We've got some bulbs to plant and some gardens to clean up.
Our gardeners are on a roof today and 40-mile-an-hour winds in Chelsea.
Yeah, but everything always gets done, so we're lucky for them and grateful
thankful
to them.
For them.
So on today's show, we continue with part three of our four-part series called Politics of Place, which is our discussion of how politics impacts horticulture, gardens, landscapes, and the people who build and admire them. On the last show, we focused on New York City and community green spaces. Mm-hmm. On today's show, we kind of go further afield. We kind of focus on a nationwide effort. In fact, we talk about rescuing and preserving America's garden heritage on a kind of national scale. And we're going to focus on formerly private landscapes and gardens that have been saved from abandonment and neglect in a variety of ways through the efforts of some remarkable individuals and institutions, and usually without any government help or support. The book that inspired this show was called Rescuing Eden by writer Carolyn Seebaum and photographer Curtis Taylor, which is published by Monticelli Press. We have both as guests today. Carolyn Seebaum is a design writer, biographer, and novelist. She's a prolific author. Her books include Boca Rococo, a biography of Palm Beach architect Addison Meisner, as well as biographies of Marietta Tree, Condé Nast, and Florida sculptor Ann Norton. Curtis Taylor is a well-known landscape and garden photographer whose work is widely published. He teaches photography at the School of Visual Arts in New York City and is an old friend of ours from our days at the Horticultural Society of New York. In fact, it was Curtis's evocative photo of Alcatraz on the cover of the book that drew me to it in the first place, and he's going to join us on the second half of the show.
Yeah, Carmen and I have an affinity for prison landscapes.
Yes, we do.
We actually do. We worked both at the Rikers Island Garden. And it was extremely informative.
Yeah, a very interesting experience.
Great, great garden.
I was wondering why you were both wearing stripes today.
we're not going to say...
I wear stripes for solidarity.
We're not going to say any more about that.
Yeah.
All right. All right. So, Carolyn, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Hi, Carolyn.
So, Let's just jump right in. You say in the introduction to the book that American private gardens have been threatened for more than a century. Tell us what some of the economic and political forces were that caused many of our earliest gardens to be lost.
I think part of it is to do with the social and cultural history of America, you know, because something I learned, as you can tell, I don't come from this country. I come from an even older country. But what I found out was that an amazing statistic that on average, American families move every 5 years. I mean, it's an astonishing thing. Therefore, they might make a garden, they might have a beautiful, wonderful garden, but then after a while, either through job searches or job movements or whatever, they move and they leave the gardens behind. Mm-hmm. And so unlike in my country where, you know, people stay in the same place for hundreds of years and tend their gardens and keep their gardens and expand their gardens, in America, people walk away and leave the most wonderful places that they've designed just to either luck or the next owner who might not care and so on. The other thing I just want to add is that in England, there's a thing called primogeniture, which means that you hand your house down to the firstborn, who happens on the whole to be a male, needless to say. Mm-hmm. In America, there's no such rule, and so there's no such law keeping houses and estates within a family. And so, again, that's another reason why so many beautiful, wonderful gardens in history have been lost.
Right.
Primogeniture. I've learned a new word.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's probably the case in Italy as well and in other European countries.
Certainly it was in France until Napoleon abolished it. But, you know, if you watch Downton Abbey and you remember all the kind of rows and dramas about who was going to inherit Downton Abbey,
yes.
That was all to do with, you know, the boys, not the girls, although Mary tried. So it's a very tough law, but it's certainly been very good for gardens.
And Britain also has the National Trust, right, which was founded in 1895 specifically to preserve the homes and gardens of historical value. And in the U.S., we're, of course, as you said, a much younger nation, and we're a lot later to the game of preservation, even though we have some gardens that rival those of Britain and Europe in their size and beauty and historical value. I'd like you to share with our listeners a little bit about Frank Cabot and how the drive to preserve one particular California garden, which was formerly a fruit farm, led to the creation of our own garden conservancy.
Well, I think actually Frank Cabot is the hero of all time in this country, and he should be given a knighthood and a lordship and everything.
If we did such things.
For American gardens, because he really started, put together the whole preservation movement in this country. And as you say, it was completely inspired by going and visiting an old lady called Ruth Bancroft, who'd made a gorgeous garden in California that had formerly been a fruit farm. And she just made this garden, and over the years it had been turned into the most fabulous place. And Frank was visiting, and she was very old, and it seemed as though when she died, there was no future planned for this garden. And Frank Cabot said, we have to do something about this. We have to somehow get everybody going. And right there and then, he founded what became the Garden Conservancy, which was one of the major, major institutions for saving historic gardens in America. It was the most wonderful thing he did.
How do they pick which gardens will go into the conservancy?
Well, people apply. You know, they write to him. In the old days, before he died, they would write to him, and Frank and a group and a team of researchers and gardeners and horticulturalists would go and visit the gardens and see what they were like and see if they thought they were worth preserving. And there could be many reasons, you know, for horticultural reasons, incredible plants, because of the most amazing design. Some of the gardens were made by some of the great American designers, like Beatrix Farrand, and mm-hmm. So those could have been lost. And also, perhaps just a location, you know, in some of these more remote places, if there was a beautiful garden, it seemed worthwhile to try and rescue it and preserve it for posterity.
So let's get into the gardens now. Carmen a few years ago went down to Charleston.
Yeah.
When actually I was tending our garden store up here in New York, she got to escape and she went down to Charleston, South Carolina.
I'd never been. And yeah. it was so extraordinary. So let's start with Middleton Place, shall we, Caroline? It's an amazing garden.
It's an amazing garden, and that, you know, was sort of inspired really by Versailles and all the great, enormous French fabulous gardens, because the first Mr. Middleton was a very passionate gardener, and he traveled in Europe and he saw what was going on there, and the family goes back to the 17th century. It's the oldest garden in our book and one of the oldest preserved gardens in in America. So it's a very, very precious place, and it's very glamorous. And if you can believe it, you know, at one time it was derelict, abandoned, forgotten, mm-hmm. and finally rescued, in this case, I think, not by the Garden Conservancy, if I'm right, but I think by the Garden Club of America, which was the other great institution that began to realize that something had to be done. And then they founded the Middleton Place Foundation and managed to put everything back together. And, of course, one of the things with this is that when you rescue a garden, you know, the question is, what did it look like originally and how much can we restore? And in this case, there were original plans, amazingly.
Wow.
And
wow.
So the gardeners could put back together a lot of what was there. They found, you know, old plants and things, and then following the plans to turn it into what you saw, which is just the most stunning, amazing landscape.
Yeah,
they say it's about the oldest surviving landscape garden in North America. I mean, you really hit the jackpot going there.
Yes, I always have to whenever I go on vacation, I do have to visit gardens, whether my husband and child like it or not. it is on the itinerary. Sometimes I inform them in advance, other times I don't. But what's interesting, when I was reading about it in the book, and your book is great because it's laid out chronologically from the oldest to the newest. And what I found interesting in that story of Middleton is that the house was burned down during the Civil War. And because the garden was kind of abandoned, it's kind of what saved it from development, that nobody really focused on it. And that's also really, really interesting as well for me.
Well, that's absolutely right, because so many fabulous gardens were then turned over to development, and parking lots and highways and all sorts of things came and, you know, ruined them. So
yeah.
Middleton Place, you're right, kind of was saved by being forgotten. That's not always the case. I mean, sometimes it's forgotten and then it's really forgotten. But in this case, it stopped other things happening to it that would have ruined it forever.
And I want to talk about I want to touch a little bit on the Garden Club of America again, because as you said, they were very instrumental. They're not just ladies who lunch and talk about, you know, their favorite plants. They did some very interesting work. They were instrumental in documenting the gardens 100 years ago. Can you tell our listeners about the lantern slides that they created and how those were used to preserve the gardens? Because that's a very interesting, like, art and garden connection, I think.
It's a wonderful thing they did. And, of course, they started when photography was not really that, you know, sophisticated. And so they had lantern slides, which was the original form of photography. You kind of look, I'm not technological, but you look through something and you saw something and you got a picture of the garden. And they meticulously recorded all the gardens that they thought should be recorded, going back, you know, to the early 20th century. And they put them all together, and they're now in the Smithsonian, and people can visit them. I mean, it's a history of American gardens that would not exist without them. I mean, it's just absolutely fantastic. And I have to say, the Garden Club of America is truly wonderful. I gave a talk at the Princeton branch of the Garden Club last week, and one of the ladies had brought a whole lot of bags of acorns from oak trees. And apparently oak trees are being, you know, cut down all over the place.
Yeah.
And so she was urging the members to take an acorn and put it in the ground and plant an oak tree. Well, I thought that was just marvelous. And yeah. Good for them.
Yeah. Alice and I have, well, we worked at the Horticultural Society of New York, which is also a very venerable old institution here in the U.S.
And in fact, some board members that are on the Hort Society are on board members of the American Garden Club.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And they, we are, those ladies, you know, don't underestimate those blue-haired ladies at all.
Oh, they have no. That is
vision
the,
and power.
And money know? And philanthropy in their blood. You know.
Absolutely, and incredible guts and determination because, yeah. you know, it's a very hard battle they're fighting all over the place because they have to fight money, development, mm-hmm. you know, airports, everything. And they are really, really tough at what they do, and they've been very, very successful. I mean, they're a fantastic group of people.
Now, if only some of them were on the board of Toll Brothers, right? The big housing development, like... You know, those McMansion houses that grace the suburbs.
Yeah.
That's what's sad is that all that land is. And like you said, you know, people are 5 years in these cheap built houses.
They don't stay long.
No.
They always, I mean, it seems to be, I guess, maybe in the American character, you're always looking for greener pastures, right? You're always looking for bigger, better. And there's something.
Well, and it's disposable.
Know.
Like it's a. Yeah. It's a You know, it's like...
I think the other thing is that, you know, that everyone wants to make their own statement. And,
right.
The famous example of this is John D. Rockefeller, the first Rockefeller, who built a fabulous house and garden in Maine, in Seal Harbor, Maine.
Right.
And it's on top of a hill and fabulous. Well, none of his children wanted it because they wanted to go off and build their own fabulous mansions
right.
and gardens.
Right.
And so... He had it razed to the ground. The house no longer exists. The garden no longer exists.
Wow.
Because they didn't want it, and he didn't want to have anybody else live in it. And so
right.
it's gone. I mean, it's just such a mad system. But anyway, that's how it is. And, of course, you know, some of the replacements are just as good. And so it's a very American story, actually.
Well, another American story that I found really interesting in the book, Carolyn, is about William Packer. I'm very fascinated by the South and gardens of the South. I don't know if it's because I am a Southern Italian. Maybe I have like an affinity with
yeah.
that part of the country. I don't know. But William...
It's the heat,
perhaps. And the plants.
And the food.
The plants, yeah. because I, you know, yeah. Southern Italy has a similar kind of plant palette in a way. But the William Packer House was really interesting. That's in Annapolis, Maryland.
Right.
And that garden, unlike Middleton, had almost no documentation at all to help.
It had no documentation. And also, that had a lot of trouble being covered over with parking lots. And a hotel was built on part of it. So that was in a very, very poor state and practically unrescuable until, again, a very wonderful group of people in Annapolis said, we want to save this garden. But the best thing about this story for me is that quite apart from just replanting these gardens, you really have to be a detective
mm-hmm.
to kind of, if there are, particularly if there aren't plans, you know, to find out what the garden really looked like because
mm-hmm.
you don't know. Well, how are you going to restore it?
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, a very, very sharp-eyed horticulturalist or garden preserver, a sort of Sherlock Holmes figure, was looking at a portrait of William Packer painted by Charles Wilson Peale in 1772, it was. And there's a, you know, very sort of formal portrait of this fellow who was a signer of the Declaration of Independence, very important man. But in the background of the portrait is a little bit of a garden and a little kind of white tower folly thing right in the background. And they rushed and looked at early, you know, documents and archives. And indeed, in the garden itself was still... this wonderful little tower.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go there now, you will see it. It's a little folly, and they've redesigned the whole alley into the folly and the way the trees and the paths went. But it's all thanks to this very sharp-eyed person who saw the original in the portrait. It's a wonderful story.
I love the intersection of painting and art, and I was really excited to see the Florence Griswold Museum house in Old Lyme, Connecticut, included. That's one of my favorite houses. And I think what I loved about it is that I found out that they were able to recreate the gardens based on the American Impressionist paintings.
Exactly. It's the same kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
There were no photographs, and there weren't really any planting plans. But the painters, Florence Griswold, had a kind of boarding house for artists.
Yeah.
And all these wonderful American Impressionist artists would come and stay in the summertime.
Mm-hmm. Mary Cassatt
and
Child Hassam.
They would paint paintings of the gardens.
Mm-hmm.
And from looking at the paintings, the restorers could see, you know, how the peonies were bunched here or the hydrangeas were bunched there. And they were able to put it back together looking at the paintings. So, you know, if you're a good detective and you like to watch paintings, you can probably be a good garden restorer.
Yeah.
So is there like an official job, like a garden?
I want that job.
Garden archaeologist.
I want to maneuver into that job.
Garden archaeologist.
Paintings and old garden designs.
So, Caroline, we have to take a break. When we come back, we're going to bring Curtis Taylor on the line, so both of you will be on, and we can talk further about gardens and rescuing gardens. Stay on the line.
New York State cares about New York's farmers. That's why we've developed the New York State Grown and Certified program. It's a seal New Yorkers can look for when they're shopping for food that comes from local farms. Customers are more likely to buy food that has the New York State Grown and Certified seal because it tells them that it comes from a farm that follows environmentally responsible, farm-safe protocols. In other words, the New York State Grown and Certified seal tells them their food is grown right, right here in New York State. You're a farmer with a lot to do, but the time it takes to sign up for the program is a great investment for your business because it lets shoppers know that your food meets higher standards, has passed assessments, and is produced by environmentally friendly farming practices. To learn about participating in the program, go to certified.ny.gov.
Hi, welcome back to Weeded Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. We are talking about preserving gardens. We have Carolyn Seebaum, the author of a book called Rescuing Eden, on the line. And now we have Curtis Taylor, the photographer of the book. Curtis, are you with us?
I am indeed.
Hi, Curtis.
Curtis.
Hi.
How are you?
Well, thanks.
Do you remember our joint show that we put together?
Oh, yes. Yes, I do. It was great fun.
I remember listening late night to the band Luna with you and hanging the show. And that was a really fun time.
It was. I remember the opening, of course, was a hideous rainstorm hit.
Yeah.
And it was, I thought it was just drowned rats.
Yeah.
Oh,
but,
gosh.
But a lot of people showed up. It's, friends are like that.
Friends are faithful, yes, just like good plants.
So, Curtis, as I mentioned in the beginning of the podcast, your photograph on the cover of the book,
mm-hmm. Yes.
Rescuing Eden, is what drew me to it. Alice and I get tons of gardening books sent to us, and we're always trolling around bookshelves in new and used bookstores looking for inspiring things. And that photograph of Alcatraz is what drew me in. It's a spectacular photograph. And I'd love for you to tell us, you know, there's so many stories of gardens. There's so many amazing gardens that are worth rescuing and that have been rescued. How did you select which ones were going to be in the book?
Well, it was two things. One is there had to be a really good rescue story. And as Caroline might have already mentioned, the gardens had to also be open to the public. So they couldn't just be saved from one rich person to another.
Right.
It had to be open to the public. And then regional diversity had something to do with it as well. That played into it.
Mm-hmm.
I wish we could have done better in the Midwest, but But we tried to, you know, be all around the country. And, you know, so sometimes it was, we had sometimes too many old estate gardens, you know, that, you know, in the previous boom times, sort of Gilded Age, and then in the 20s, there were lots of, you know, very wealthy people building gardens. And unfortunately, they all, a lot of them looked alike. You know, they all had a sunken garden, and they all had a rose garden, and they all had a pool, and they all, you know, so they kind of looked alike. So we went for either the sort of more eccentric ones, you know, of that period. Mm-hmm. I think Greenwood Gardens in Short Hills, New Jersey, would be one of those. It was an estate garden, but a really eccentric and wonderful one. Which had a wonderful salvage
story as well. And then something like Untermeyer, the Untermeyer Gardens in Yonkers.
Yes.
Well, of course.
You know,
yes,
aren't
yes.
like anything else in the whole country. That was a wonderful discovery.
Exactly, exactly. So, you know, and that one was saved. I mean, that almost didn't make it into the book because it's such a recent save, the Untermeyer Garden.
Yes.
I spent 10 years working on the book. So I had to actually go back and rephotograph Greenwood because they'd actually done quite a bit of restoration on it. And when I first photographed it, it was really crumbling.
Mm-hmm.
It has a long way to go still, but these are very gradual regressions. And the Alcatraz photo and the story, I mean, who wouldn't love that story? I mean, you know, it's just unbelievable.
Right.
It was an interesting discussion with the publisher as to put that on the cover or not. I think I gave them 5 images I thought would be a good cover photo, and people kept coming back to that one.
Yes.
For the very reasons
you suggest.
The
interesting thing is, Curtis, was that so few people recognized it. I mean, not that everybody's been to Alcatraz, obviously, but nobody guessed where I've been, where it ever was in the first place. And the thing is, it's now, you know, incredibly popular, and 1 million people visit it every year. And a friend of mine told me that she'd just been there, and the flowers now are even more dazzling and beautiful than they were when Curtis first photographed it. It's a fantastic story, you know, and it's about these wonderful, this wonderful warden who thought that the inmates should be given a chance to kind of have some therapy,
right.
And so started to make the gardens. And the inmates really responded, and as we know, garden therapy is hugely important and effective. And they really found some sort of reason for living and being a good person and things. And they said, this was one thing I could do well in my life here as a, you know, maximum security criminal. And so it was altogether a very good thing, and it was wonderful that although the prison closed and it got very neglected, it was rescued. And now, you know, it's now, in fact, very, very difficult. You have to book ages in advance to get there, but it's a fantastic success story.
Well, it was. So it used to be easy to get in, and now it's not so easy to get into Alcatraz.
Well, the story of a lot of these, and of course, the secret, you'll notice that there are no people in these gardens throughout the book. I mean, these are all public gardens, and people said to me, well, how did you do that? And I said, well, for instance, in the case of Alcatraz, I was on the first boat out in the morning with the staff.
Right.
So I could shoot before the public came in. And then I would often go to these gardens on the days that they're closed to the public. And it's not elitism that I didn't want people in them. People tend to date photographs with their clothes.
Sure,
right.
And invariably, you know, you'll have people wearing, you know, nice muted colors, and there's one person with a bright red sweater on, and it kind of ruins everything. So so it's sort of best to just not have people around.
Well, let's stay on that topic a little bit, Curtis. I'm sure you've taken tens of thousands of photographs.
I have indeed.
And tell us a little bit more about the process of working on the book and, like, what you wanted to accomplish in selecting the photos. Because, you know, a number of the gardens are quite large. How did you kind of winnow it down to get this sort of essence of the garden in just a few photographs for each?
Well, that's, you know, you edit tightly, and you also trust that the publisher agrees with you. Carolyn and I, you know, had we lost a couple of battles on a couple of pictures, but generally we won them. And, you know, you just, it was hard for me because I go to a garden that I've always wanted, you know, to go to, and at last I had Lotus Land being one of them.
Yeah.
That I'd never been to, but always heard about and wanted to. And indeed, I could have been somewhat cynical or quick and said, okay, we know they're only going to use six pictures and you know, run around and take those and leave. But it's such an enchanting place that I've always wanted to be that I stayed for hours and hours. And in fact, the director of it stayed late in his office. And we were both the last people to leave. and one of my favorite pictures in the book is a kind of mid view of the cactuses. That was the last shot I took, but before we left. So sometimes it was very difficult, like with that one, because I had so many pictures.
Right.
Others, which were being restored, or I had to sort of be very selective to sort of avoid the rubble and try to show the parts that were being. And that was certainly the case at Alcatraz. Alcatraz on the San Francisco side, they were just really restoring them then, and it was sort of difficult to find nice bits to get. But that's what you do. You know, you try to find the essence, first of all. I always say to people that, and you'll notice there's not a lot of flower pictures in the book.
No.
I say I'm not a flower photographer. I'm a garden design photographer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what interests me, is the design of gardens and the relations of plants and structures, et cetera, because it's about architecture.
Well, I was actually looking through the book, and I was thinking about, like, the mid-century garden. It's kind of missing.
Well, that's a very good question. Well, we have the 40s to the 90s, but you see there's not many of them.
Right. Yeah.
It's broken down that way. We decided to do it. This is Caroline's input. We weren't sure how we were going to do it, and we just decided to do it chronologically,
mm-hmm.
sort of because if you do it regionally, we'd have some very long sections and very short ones as well.
Right.
There was one modernist garden, which I won't mention, which just wasn't very responsive to us. And, you know, after a month of trying, I thought, well, why should I knock myself out?
Right.
And then we only were turned down by one garden, which was a Heronswood. In Washington.
Uh-huh.
And they just, it was weird. They said they wouldn't let me take photographs, that they would supply the photograph. They also wanted to approve of anything we wrote about it. And no one came up with that, so I just said, I'm sorry. It's a great rescue story, but...
Don't they know who you are, Curtis? they don't know who you are, Curtis.
Well,
how dare they? We'll speak to them.
Yes.
Well, harumph is all I can say.
Harumph is exactly right.
Well, you did photograph two amazing West Coast gardens, mm-hmm. that I want to talk about, because I think their stories are interesting. And of course, Caroline, jump in here. The ones I'm referring to is the two Oregon gardens made by Elizabeth Lord and Edith Shriver,
yes.
Who are ladies that are not as well known as their mentors, Beatrix Ferrand and Ellen Biddle Shipman. But
right.
They also broke a few boundaries in their time. Tell us about them a bit and what their contributions were.
Well, one of the interesting things is, of course, they were working in the Pacific Northwest, which is not a kind of obvious garden spot.
Right.
And so they were in Salem, Oregon, and they met, I think, in the mid-1920s on a study tour, and they got together. And, of course, we didn't go into their private lives, Curtis. Did
No.
you go into their private lives? But they were the two women who lived together and worked together for the rest of their lives. So let us not speculate on what went on under the garden walls, so to speak.
In the hedgerow.
But anyway,
yeah.
They were very successful locally. They did very well, and they had one wonderful, very rich client, which is always very, very helpful. And she asked them to make them her garden, and it was a wonderful, big, glamorous garden. And they were very independent. You know, they took some European ideas. They had their own ideas. They liked to mix formal and informal. And they were very, very talented and did a wonderful, wonderful job, I think. And then finally, again, when they died, there were enough people in Salem who knew that they had been the most important garden designers since Farrand, really. And so they got together, and now there's a the Friends of Deepwood, which was the name of the client's house, and now the Lord and Shriver Conservancy, again, to preserve their legacy. Mm-hmm. And I think they're now preserving, they had their own little garden in the middle of Salem, a little town garden, and they're now preserving that. So,
right, yes, their
it's
own
It's very
garden,
exciting. Yeah. I think that's one of the most exciting gardens for me in the book, to be able to kind of showcase this couple who aren't well known, but I think deserve to be much better known and are just as talented as, you know, Farrand and Shipman, really.
Right.
Indeed, indeed.
And somebody
and
else
not,
can write
not,
their biography.
You know, they're not unique. These, you know, women were not often celebrated for their garden designs because they often did it for friends, or they were, you know,
right.
Women weren't supposed to have jobs, all these things we know. So they, but this is something that they could, whether it's Edith Sackville West kind of worked that way too, you know.
Uh-huh.
And the wealthy friends like what they do, and they sort of do it as favors, but it doesn't
right.
mean that the talent and industry isn't there. It certainly is.
Well, let's also then jump in the last few minutes to Pearl Fryer, right?
Oh,
talk
yes.
about an outsider.
Yes,
and
indeed.
What an amazing! He was on our radio show very early on.
Yeah, years ago.
On our podcast before the garden was actually accepted into the Conservancy.
Right.
So, Carolyn and Curtis, tell our listeners about that garden, because I just love the story of him.
I think that's Curtis. Over to you with this one. He knows
well,
more than I do.
It is, and it's in the middle of sort of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get to it, and you drive through, you know, a very small town. And then what's marvelous is that you drive. This is in Bishopsville, and you drive into a middle class, you know, street.
Right.
With little brick houses that are all kind of the same, built in the 50s, I'm assuming. There's one picture which they didn't use, which I did it on purpose. I photographed through the topiary to an 18-wheeler that was parked on the neighbor's front lawn.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the kind of neighborhood it is.
Yeah.
These are working people.
Yeah.
And the other great thing is, which I didn't show because it's not really what's relevant, but what he did to the street was a neighbor asked him to do a couple of topiary things for him.
Right.
And so he did. And then the neighbor next door thought they could do it themselves, so they've done theirs.
Uh-huh.
And then there's another one down the street.
Yeah.
It's marvelous how this spread.
He's affected the whole neighborhood.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And people are terribly proud of it.
And he rescued every single one of these shrubs.
Yes, yes, from this nursery down the street. And as you probably know, as you probably said, many of these, the bushes that he used have never been, if there's such a word as topiarized,
right.
Before. But he just thought, well, I'll use them and I'll cut them. And he cut them and they were perfectly fine.
Yeah.
I also heard that, that people sent him, when they heard about this garden, they would send him books from Europe and whatnot, and he refused to read them. He didn't want to be tainted by them.
Yeah.
Rosemary Vary sent him. Maybe she met him and she sent him a book, and he wouldn't read it.
Yeah. Well,
because he didn't want to be polluted by the English.
Exactly.
I guess.
Exactly.
But, no offense, Caroline. But anyway.
Yeah.
But it's sort of marvelous. I unfortunately did not meet him because Martha Stewart. Had just left.
Oh.
And she'd been there for 3 days, and he was so exhausted that he went off to stay with friends.
Yeah,
so
sure.
I couldn't see him. I desperately wanted to meet him, but it was lovely being alone there. People from the Conservancy helped me, and were there for me. But
right,
as I said, it's just one of these magical places that you know, a person gets bit by gardening, and this is what can happen.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I think your story, Curtis, is an interesting story as well, how you got into landscape and garden photography. Would you mind sharing that with our listeners? Because it was very interesting to read that in the book as well.
Well, speaking of the English, right. yes, my father had met Russell Page right after the war in London at a literary party. And they became very good friends. And he was coming out with Education of a Gardener was being written at the time. My father did not publish that, but was certainly aware of it, and maybe even Russell sent him some galleys. But so when I was a struggling photographer in New York, and with an emphasis on the struggling, was sort of going nowhere fast, and I got a call from him one day explaining that the photographer from Country Life was too inebriated to work. That he needed a substitute, and could I photograph a garden? And I said, well, I guess I can. And so the next day, William Paley, the chairman of CBS, pulled up at my Soho cold water flat and whisked me off to Manhasset, and Russell met me, and he told me things like, he said, don't use a wide angle lens because it distorts the landscape, which is true, and you know, it's best to photograph very early in the morning. The car picked me up at 6, mm-hmm. And late in the afternoon into the evening, which I did, so I took those very important pointers from him. What's funny is Russell took lots of pictures of his garden, and he was a really bad photographer. he was great at giving me advice on how to do it, but he was terrible at doing it himself. In the last edition, I think, of Education of a Gardener, there is a color insert. There were never color pictures in the original, and those are all my pictures. So they.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I did the cover as well. But it's nice that finally we're together. So literally, it was just when the magazines were, the House and Garden, if you all remember,
right.
Years and years ago, was sort of like Better Homes and Gardens.
Right.
It wasn't a high-end, a glossy magazine at all, and mm-hmm. that was right around that time that they went upscale, and no one, you know, there are very few people photographing gardens in America.
Mm-hmm.
So I just came to them with, I think, 2 gardens I'd photographed. That's it. That was my total portfolio. with one of them being Russell Page,
yeah.
You know, kind of helped.
Yeah.
You know, and 2 weeks later, I was on a plane to Italy to go photograph Villa Lante.
Great.
So, yeah. You know, it really was, my whole career was founded on that. And then, of course, that garden, I was photographing it for Mr. Paley because he was he was planning on moving on because his wife had died, Babe mm-hmm. Paley. And I think the place, it just depressed him too much to be there because it was so her.
Right. Mm,
and she was very involved in the design of it with Russell, and they became extremely close. And in fact, Russell was there not just to photograph the garden, but he was there to do a series of hedges around Babe Paley's gravesite.
Mm. Oh.
Yeah.
Wow.
And it was just kind of interesting because, you know, Russell is buried sort of anonymously I'm gonna forget which one of the greenhouses it is. Boy, I should have mentioned it without knowing the fact. But he's just under a tree. I mean, there's no marker or anything.
Really?
He's buried under a tree,
wow.
Yeah. He never had a garden of his own either, which was kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's it's just the serendipity of it that's so interesting, Curtis. Well, Karen,
yeah.
It was so great to have you both on. I wish we had more time. We could talk for hours about rescuing gardens.
I want to meet you all and have lunch.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Can
we do that?
Wonderful.
Absolutely.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, I highly recommend that you all get Rescuing Eden.
It's a great book. It's
a beautiful book. The photography is wonderful. The writing is wonderful. And it'll inspire your next vacation, I guarantee you.
Yes.
So thank you both for being on the show today.
And thank you for all of your hard work.
Thank you for having us.
To bring this to, you know, the public. We need this, especially in this climate.
Yes.
It's a great cause.
Let's buy a lot of them, and then we'll have volume two.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. The ones that didn't make it in, exactly. Yeah. So thank you both.
That would be a whole other book.
So the show has been written and produced by Carmen DeVito and Alice Krieg. Please remember to check out our new website, WeDigPlantsPodcast.com, or on Twitter at WeDigPlants to stay current on our projects and upcoming shows. Or you can follow us on Instagram at Groundworks Gardens NYC. Thanks for listening.
Happy gardening.
See you in the garden.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola El-Waeli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.